Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 568th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta.
So, Mike, when I say the word statistics, what does that do to you?
It hurts me, first of all.
Well, statistics.
Yeah, it conjures up visions of deception, and no, it doesn't. But, and it's central to every, well, the last, how many podcasts did you say we were at?
Yeah, 500, yeah, this is 567.
Before this. And again, statistics plus or minus the 600 I said, that's accurate.
Yeah.
I don't think there's been a podcast to date that we haven't talked about statistics, or maybe a handful.
Yeah. And in fact, I think we did a statistics podcast many, many years ago, but we're sort of going to not build on it, but I don't think that was very good. Statistically speaking, it wasn't very good.
No, it was terrible. Well, everything, and I think I ran that one, so of course.
Oh, yes. Well, there you go.
Yeah. And now we're going to do it right because you're leading this one.
Yes, I think that's the way it works. So anyway, if you haven't figured out what we're going to talk about statistics. And all the entire, this whole thought.
Before you turn it off, hang on, before you turn off the podcast.
We're going to make it, so this is, this will actually be, I hope, be of interest, not just in the medicine area. It's just basically for living. You kind of need to know this stuff. So we'll talk about that as we get going on it. And where it all came from was, there's a thing called the Sensible Medicine Substack, which is a sort of a place where you can post stuff that you write if you wish. And it's sort of moderated by John Mandrola, who's a cardiologist, and Adam Seifer. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. He's a professor of medicine in general internal medicine, and he writes really interesting stuff around his career. And then Vinay Prasad, who I think a number of you know, he's a professor of medicine, but he also does a lot of stuff in the health policy researcher, and he's very outspoken about a variety of different things. But John had a guest on talking about statistics, and so I emailed him, and as I was listening to it, I said, I think there's a few things you're not getting them completely wrong, but there's a few things that you might want to think about. And he was very generous, and he said, you know, we'd love it if you'd write an article on this. And so myself and a colleague, Mark Levine, got together and wrote an article called Doing Statistics Can Be Difficult, But Understanding Them Can Be Fairly Simple. And I think you'd agree, Mike, right, that doing them is not, and in fact, you and I don't really do them very often, but we can interpret
them. Well, we do sometimes. We do a lot of meta-analysis, and sometimes chi-square and Fisher's exact, and some others. But I think some of the things that we have to remember at the outset about statistics is we view it as yes or no truth gospel.
Yeah.
And the interpretation of statistics varies between some very high profile. We're going to try and give you kind of the Cole's Notes simplified version and how you can think about them, but recognize that there will be a statistician out there who does not entirely agree with our interpretation of, for example, confidence intervals or p-values. But it's going to be mostly right and allow you to interpret the numbers and values that you're given. So when you're told something that this is statistically significant, you're going to have a better understanding. Yeah. But this is not – I was shocked to find out, and very few things are really – gravity, but not a lot else is certain. That doesn't mean that we can't shed some light on it and help make it more easy to understand.
Yeah, and statistics are not just in medicine. I mean, they are on every newscast. They're on every election, all that sort of stuff. So they are fundamentally important to understand if you're going to sort of interact with the world.
Yeah, the first time, I mean, we used them obviously in my science degree, but I remember one of my first research papers was, and we've joked about this before, I used to study ecology and wildlife, and it was trying to figure out the size of a population of an introduced species on Vancouver Island and how the statistics that go behind that, which are fascinating and probably should supplant this podcast. James, would you like me to?
I was just going to say. Calculated. So we dared to tread on the concept of statistics, and now you're going to birds.
No, it was lizards.
But oh, lizards. Oh, I thought you said birds.
Equally exciting.
Oh, okay.
Equally exciting.
Yeah. I thought that's. I actually fell asleep. That's why I thought you said birds. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
He dripped off.
Yeah. So a number of you probably heard of, you know, sort of the typical quotes about statistics, like facts are stubborn, but statistics are more pliable. That's sort of Mark Twain. And there are three kinds of lies, damned lies, and statistics. And that's a guy from, apparently from a guy named Benjamin Disraeli, I think, even though some people think Mark Twain said it, but it doesn't matter who said it. But there are, and then there was another one, there are two ways of lying, one not telling the truth and the other making up statistics. And that was Josefina Vazquez Mota. And I think they are actually correct in that if you don't understand the concepts of statistics, you will get fooled over and over again. But if you understand statistics, then there's a bunch of other quotes that I think are really useful. As an example, without data, you're just another person with an opinion. And I think would you agree with that, or do you have an opinion on that, Mike?
No, I think it's exactly. I don't have any data to support it, but I have an opinion.
Yeah.
No, we need that, right? We need to. Scott has a great expression, Scott Garrison, which is the plural of anecdote is not data.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, exactly. It's a great one. He stole that from someone, but that's okay.
I'm sure. Well, yeah, we all do.
Yeah. And then another one is, it's the mark of a truly intelligent person to be moved by statistics. That's George Bernard Shaw. Now, I don't know if that's true, but there you go. Because I'm moved by statistics and I don't think that means that. And then our assent ought to be regulated by the grounds of probability. And that's a guy named John Locke. Yeah, I know that's way too cerebral, but
that's a little it's a little too highbrow for this podcast.
Yeah. So anyway, the bottom line is we think there is value to understand statistics, and there's a whole slew of statistics that we can talk about. But really, there are really two basic types of statistics. I'll mention the word Bayesian a couple of times, but we won't get into too much detail. But there's descriptive statistics and inferential statistics. So please don't fall asleep yet, but we'll get there. So descriptive statistics.
Now, James, when you're talking about Bayesian statistics, are you right? Like, I don't know if the people at home can see you moving your finger in the shape of a bell curve.
Yes, that is true. But it's not. But Bayesian is not just a bell curve. We might talk about
it. I know.
But yeah. So I think most people can appreciate descriptive statistics. And all that means is when you say the average of something is this, so the median is this, and basically descriptive statistics describe the properties of any sample, whether it be a very large sample or a small sample. And an example of that would be when there's an election, you know, maybe 10,000 people voted and the results were 65% for party A and 35% for party B, and the average age was 47 and 55% for female. Those are all descriptive statistics. And I think we're going to go with a premise anyway that most people understand that concept, and that's not where people get fooled. And I think you'd also agree with that, eh, Mike?
That's correct. So the descriptive statistics are the things that you use every day when you're talking. You might say half of my day today was meetings or something like that. Those are classic descriptive statistics.
Yeah, that's a great example.
Most people in the office are over age 50 or something. You can imagine these are all, and those aren't accurate, nearly as accurate as the example you gave, but we're using that kind of stuff all the time. It's actually where you're trying to interpret from a sample.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
James, I won't steal your thunder. So
No, but you're exactly right. And I think from the sample perspective, so those are all descriptive statistics. Now, where you can confuse with a sample is to sample the incorrect population and then express them as if they were from a population that you cared about. But that's a different story, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Now, as many of you probably know, when you do an election as an example, you don't actually have to do any inferential or deductive statistics, and we'll talk about that in just a few minutes. Because by definition, when we count the entire population of people who voted, we know the exact results. So there really is no debate about those sorts of descriptive sorts of statistics, you know, obviously unless the, you know, election was improperly run. But improperly running an election has nothing to do with descriptive statistics. No. So that's just descriptive statistics. Now, when the, not the opposite side, but on the other hand, if we don't study an entire population, and that's very common, like it's almost impossible. We could never study the entire population of someone who's going to take a statin. That would make no sense, right?
Well, it'd be way too many people. Yeah. So you have to, there's lots of ways that even from the descriptive statistics, you can jump to inferential. Like how well does that population of the people who voted represent the real population?
Yeah.
That's another piece. But what you're saying is you've sampled a group of people and you're hoping that you can interpret what happened with those to a larger population.
Exactly. And that's called inferential statistics. And that's where you get into all of those terms that you hear about p-values and confidence intervals. And then in the media, whether you may not know this, but that's what the margin of error is. It really is just a confidence interval. But fortunately, although I think that's probably marginally easier to understand, it's because could you imagine if they started to talk about p-values and confidence intervals in an election? They would, everyone would basically go into a coma. So,
and if you think about inferential, because you're trying to infer something from these statistics, that's where the term comes from.
Yeah. So, so often, if you're doing inferential statistics, and we'll go back to, how people are going to potentially vote, and that might be a poll as an example. What we're doing is we have an entire population of voters, but we are going to sample a subset of them. And then, just as you were saying, Mike, try and go, is this representative of what the entire population would be doing? So we can have descriptive statistics of that sample. We might say there was 1,000 people that were evaluated. Their average age was 29 and 55% were male. So we can do descriptive on statistics on that. But what we really want to do when we get into these margin of errors and p-values is we want to guesstimate, basically, before the election, what do we think is going to happen in that election. So the entire purpose is for us to basically make a guesstimate of what we believe the true results would be. And that could be polling or studies. Really, I guess you could sort of say a study or a trial, if you would, a study as well, but a trial is really polling of a medical issue.
Especially like a general study. A trial is, even more selective.
Yeah, exactly.
Certainly that's what you're doing. You're kind of, and there's all sorts of layers in your estimate there because you do a poll of a sample of the general population, but that general population sample might not even be the voting population.
No, exactly.
Because they're different. So there's a lot of layers. Even when you remove the margins of error, the actual inferential statistics, there's still assumptions that lie.
No, exactly. So when you see a poll result being presented, it will often say, you've probably seen it when you see it on the TV or in the newspaper, it says margin of error typically plus minus 3%. And that really is just simply describing the width of the 95% confidence interval. And we're going to talk about why 95% is an issue in a bit. But basically, plus minus 3 means that 3 would be half of the confidence interval. So when you get a number that comes back, let's say it's 30%, we believe, and we'll talk about beliefs and all that sort of stuff in a minute, that the result is likely, and I know my Bayesian colleagues are going to get on my case for saying that, because likely implies a probability and you can't do that. But nonetheless, that's the way I talk about it. It means if it was 30%, it's probably plus minus 3% or between 27 and 33. That's basically what that does. And then when we put it into studies and trials and that sort of stuff, we're talking about p-values and confidence intervals, but it's exactly the same thing. So that's where we're going. So we need to do inferential statistics to figure out if that's what's going on. So let's say the results of a single poll done before the full election reported that 40% of the people said they would vote for a particular party. You're going to get a margin of error. And this is interesting. I think it's interesting, Mike, but almost all poll sizes are around 1,000. I don't know if you knew that.
I did not know that. But we often have magic numbers.
Yeah. And it is a bit of a magic number, and we'll talk about why that is. But these are not, doing polls are expensive, relatively speaking, and you've got to, talk to 1,000 people. And just because you double the number of people who are in the poll doesn't mean that you really get that much better of an estimate. So we'll talk about that later on. But anyway, if there's a margin of error around the 30% or 40%, it's somewhere between plus minus 3%. Now, where the exact interpretation of what this range means gets a bit tricky. So I'm going to try to explain it, and then Mike, you're going to doubly explain it as well. How about that?
Okay, awesome.
Yeah. So here's what's really important to realize, and it's one of the most important things that was taught to me when after I learned statistics, because I didn't learn it properly, and how to think about it. A margin of error does not mean we know the true result is between, say, the 27 and the 33. It doesn't mean that, even though some statisticians might say that. In fact, and this makes really a lot of sense, we can never know the true result until after we have the election. So we can't use any poll to say we know that the result is somewhere in between those two. All we can say, and I'll say hopefully as clearly as possible and as slowly as possible, if we were to do a similar poll 100 times, the true result, which we can't know until we have the election, would be found between 95 of those 100 unique plus minus 3% ranges. So in other words, we do 100 polls, each one of those has a unique margin of error, and for 95% of those, it would contain the true result, but we still don't know what that true result is. That's the best I could do. Mike, what's your take on it?
Well, I've heard you say it before that if you did it 100 times, 95% of the time, there would be some overlap in the confidence intervals. It's basically the way I've heard.
Yeah, sort of. What it really means is that if we were to do 100 polls, 95% of the confidence intervals from those 100 polls would contain the true result. But again, we don't know. So all we can say is if you have a single poll or a single trial result, you will have a margin of error around it. And if you were to do it 100 times, 95% of them will contain the true result, but 5% don't. So That's the problem, is 5% of them do not contain the true result. The problem is you don't know which ones. That's why we have to do multiple polls. And what we would love is multiple trials, but we often don't have that. We often just have a single one.
Mm-hmm. And we'll look for other things within there. So internal consistencies, that kind of thing. So if for example, you're looking at cardiovascular disease outcomes, you'd like to see that things are headed in the right way for each outcome and that kind of thing. So stroke, MI, all of that kind of thing. So there is some internal consistency.
Yeah, no, exactly. So if you get if a single poll comes back and it's 40% plus minus 3%, I think, and again, the Bayesian people don't like it when I say it this way, but I think it's reasonable to conclude that single interval contains the true value, because 95% of such intervals would actually contain the true value. But we can't
95% of the time it will contain the true value.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's important to realize that inferential statistics don't give us a probability. You can't say we are 95% sure that the result is in there. That's not what we can say. It doesn't really matter as long as you realize that when we're talking about a 95% confidence interval, that's what a confidence interval means. So let's get back to doing a poll. So we're going to do a poll. And like I was saying, typical polls are about 1,000 people. Because when you do 1,000 people, the margin of error around that is plus minus 3%. If you were to only poll 100 people, you get plus minus 10%. So if you go from 100 up to 1,000, you can really quite tightly narrow that margin of error. But now where it gets tricky is it's a law of diminishing returns. If you go to 2,500 people and do a poll, instead of it being plus minus 3%, it's now plus minus 2%. So you'd have to, do 2.5 times as much polling to change that confidence interval by 1%. And then if you wanted to get it to plus minus 1%, you'd have to do a poll of 10,000 people. That's enough. Just so you know that I can do math, that's 10 times more than 1,000, Mike.
Wow. Thank you for that, James.
Yeah.
I can see this is a numbers podcast.
Yes, it is. And so that's the problem that we run into, not only with polls, but we can only study so many people. that's, you know, if it, because it becomes time intensive, it becomes cost prohibitive and all that sort of stuff. So that's the sort of thought. That's why when you see any sort of a poll, it's almost always 1,000. Now that's a number that was, like you said, it wasn't decreed by anybody, but that's what's normally done because you can't get that much better unless you go to a heck of a lot more work.
Yeah, and this is kind of like calculating your sample size, right?
Yeah, exactly.
When we do that in medicine, and for medicine, it's driven by a lot of things. The difference here is that this isn't something that only happens to a few people. You're polling everyone and expecting to get their opinion out of the 1,000. So it's kind of like everyone who studied for depression will have a depression score, everyone in it. In a study where you're looking at people with who have a cardiovascular event, only a tiny portion of the people in the study will actually have a cardiovascular event.
Right.
So it's another layer removed when you're calculating sample size, but it's the same basic principle. You need, how many people do you need to show, in this case, it's statistical significance, but how many people do you need to be somewhat confident about your results?
Yeah. No, exactly. So that's polls. I don't know if we need to spend much more time, but that's a poll. But the reason we thought we'd explain it that way is because polls are just another form of an inferential statistics. But it is important to realize, as we said earlier, though, that there's a number of biases that we can get from a poll. I mean, the samples may not have been equally true across sections of the population. Even if you, and I know you know this as well, if you change how you ask the question, it can really affect the poll, not just the poll, but also in clinical trials when you're asking about pain or anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you wouldn't. There are certain, so if you, in your published study here, James, or published analysis, you talk about U.S. polling for an election between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. You can imagine how you sample the population will drive a lot because it's there's more people in certain states, but they don't necessarily, they have a fixed amount of electoral colleges, so that will affect. So if you try and do it by demographics, you actually have to balance by electoral colleges. You have to sample the right neighborhoods because certain states will have more rural representation and more urban people will be different from rural. So there's all sorts of things that go into the background of the polling in how you sample that can affect the reliability of the polling, even as much as that kind of plus or minus you've been talking about,
exactly.
The kind of confidence interval. Those are the things, like we can look at statistics and studies of cardiovascular disease and say, well, it was, you know, 0.03 p-value, so it's likely real. But if it was the wrong sample, if, you know, randomization didn't happen, if all sorts of things can take away the validity aside from statistics.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah,
and interpretation is so, and statistics are hard, but it's also so many layers removed from that as well.
No, exactly. And then the only other things with polls is you can imagine, and this, just think of clinical trials as well. Sponsors may decide whether or not to release the poll.
For sure.
That's the public. That's a publication bias, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then, you know what, and then there's sort of, there's other biases, the non-response bias, if people don't respond, or the acquiescence bias, or social desirability bias, where we, and this, I think there's some similarities where you kind of go, well, if someone asks me, you know, what do you think of X politician, and you're embarrassed about saying, yes, I like that politician, you may not say that.
Absolutely. Imagine if, again, in the example of the U.S., this is a Fox News poll that will generate different immediate opinions from the people and their comfort versus if they get a call from MSNBC.
Yeah.
Right. And that worked both ways. So there's all sorts of things that influence the results outside of just the basic statistics.
Yeah. And the last two is just really the question order. Cause you can lead a person down a garden path with the question order, and then also interviewer bias. You know, it's very hard to speak that the a poll without sometimes letting on that you have a bias. I'm sure that the people who do polls for a living do it properly, but those are the problems. So what we've done now is describe a little bit about descriptive statistics, and then we've sort of started to delve into inferential statistics, and also talked about how they apply to polls and elections. And in the next podcast, I think we'll take that information and start to talk about how we use those in clinical trials. How does that sound like?
Sounds awesome,
Jim. Does it sound like captivating to you?
I'm captivated. I am going to hold my breath for the next podcast.
Wow. Good luck on that one. Well, actually, fortunately, we're going to probably record it right after this one. So, you're not that much.
I might make it.
Yeah, yeah. So just a couple of comments. We would love it if you would attend our meme conference, Making Evidence Matter to Everyone, in Vancouver. It's coming up May 24th and 25th. You can go to our website, hectalks.org. I always forget whether it's org or com. It's one of those two. Try it out. Have a look, and we've got some really good speakers. We've got some really interesting topics, and we would love it if you attend. Anything else, Mike?
No, other than please, if you're interested in getting credits for listening to this podcast, remember that you can sign in to CFPC Learn and become a subscriber. And then when you listen to the podcast, you can receive half a credit per podcast, and those are automatically entered into your records, so that you don't need to do that work. It's an automatic process.
Yeah, and I think it's appropriate that our podcasts are not worth a full credit.
It's a time based.
No,
thing,
I know.
But James, I wanna build you up. There's probably some confidence that you need.
Yeah.
So we can talk about your confidence intervals next podcast.
Nice segue. Beautiful. Not a segue, because we're ending it. Anyway, there you go. Thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.